Disc 10. The passage, two paces deep, opened through a heavy door into a square office lighted by golden glow globes. Jessica passed her hand across the door as she entered, was startled to identify Plasteel. Paul stepped three paces into the room, dropped his pack to the floor. He heard the door close behind him, studied the place. About 8 meters to a side, walls of natural rock, curry-colored, broken by metal filing cabinets on their right. A low desk with milk glass top shot full of yellow bubbles occupied the room's center. 4 suspensor chairs ringed the desk. Kynes moved around Paul, held a chair for Jessica. She sat down, noting the way her son examined the room. Paul remained standing for another eye blink. A faint anomaly in the room's air currents told him there was a secret exit to their right behind the filing cabinets. "Will you sit down, Paul Atreides?" Kynes asked. How carefully he avoids my title, Paul thought. But he accepted the chair, remained silent while Kynes sat down. "You sense that Arrakis could be a paradise," Kynes said. "Yet, as you see, the Imperium sends here only its trained hatchetmen, its seekers after the spice." Paul held up his thumb with its ducal signet. "Do you see this ring?"
"Yes."
"Do you know its significance?" Jessica turned sharply to stare at her son. "Your father lies dead in the ruins of Arrakeen," Kynes said. "You are technically the Duke." "I'm a soldier of the Imperium," Paul said. "Technically, a hatchet man." Kynes' face darkened. "Even with the Emperor's Sardaukar standing over your father's body?" "The Sardaukar are one thing. The legal source of my authority is another," Paul said. "Arrakis has its own way of determining who wears the mantle of authority," Kynes said. And Jessica, turning back to look at him, thought, "There's steel in this man that no one has taken the temper out of. And we've need of steel. Paul's doing a dangerous thing." Paul said, "The Sardaukar on Arrakis are a measure of how much our beloved Emperor feared my father. Now, I will give the Padishah Emperor reasons to fear the—" "Lad," Kynes said, "there are things you don't—" "You will address me as sire or my lord," Paul said. "Gently," Jessica thought. Kynes stared at Paul, and Jessica noted the glint of admiration in the planetologist's face, the touch of humor there. "Sire," Kynes said. "I am an embarrassment to the Emperor," Paul said. "I am an embarrassment to all who would divide Arrakis as their spoil. As I live, I shall continue to be such an embarrassment that I stick in their throats and choke them to death." "Words," Kynes said. Paul stared at him. Presently, Paul said, "You have a legend of the Lisan al-Ghaib here. The voice from the outer world. The one who will lead the Fremen to paradise." "Your men have superstition," Kynes said.
"Perhaps,"
Paul agreed. "Yet perhaps not. Superstitions sometimes have strange roots and stranger branchings." "You have a plan," Kynes said. "This much is obvious." "Sire, could your Fremen provide me with proof positive that the Sardaukar are here in Harkonnen uniform?" "Quite likely." "The Emperor will put a Harkonnen back in power here," Paul said. "Perhaps even Beast Raban." "Let him. Once he has involved himself beyond escaping his guilt, let the Emperor face the possibility of a bill of particulars laid before the Landsraad. Let him answer there where—"
Paul,
Jessica said. Granted that the Landsraad High Council accepts your case, Kynes said, there could be only one outcome. General warfare between the Imperium and the Great Houses.
Chaos, Jessica said.
But I'd present my case to the Emperor, Paul said, and give him an alternative to chaos. Jessica spoke in a dry tone. Blackmail? One of the tools of statecraft, as you've said yourself, Paul said, and Jessica heard the bitterness in his voice. The Emperor has no sons, only daughters.
You'd aim for the throne, Jessica asked.
The Emperor will not risk having the Imperium shattered by total war, Paul said. Planets blasted, disorder everywhere. He'll not risk that.
This is a desperate gamble you propose, Kynes said.
What do the great houses of the Landsraad fear most? Paul asked. They fear most what is happening here, right now on Arrakis. The Sardaukar picking them off one by one. That's why there is a Landsraad. This is the glue of the Great Convention. Only in union do they match the Imperial forces.
But this is what they fear, Paul said.
Arrakis would become a rallying cry. Each of them would see himself in my father, cut out of the herd and killed.
Kynes spoke to Jessica.
Would his plan work?
I'm no Mentat, Jessica said.
But you are Bene Gesserit.
She shot a probing stare at him, said, his plan has good points and bad points.
As any plan would at this stage. A plan depends as much upon execution as it does upon concept.
Law is the ultimate science, Paul quoted.
Thus it reads above the Emperor's door.
I propose to show him law.
And I'm not sure I could trust the person who conceived this plan, Kynes said.
Arrakis has its own plans that we...
From the throne, Paul said, I could make a paradise of Arrakis with the wave of a hand. This is the coin I offer for your support.
Kynes stiffened.
My loyalty's not for sale, sire.
Paul stared across the desk at him, meeting the cold glare of those blue-within-blue eyes, studying the bearded face, the commanding appearance.
A harsh smile touched Paul's lips, and he said,
"Well spoken. I apologize."
Kynes met Paul's stare and presently said, "No Harkonnen ever admitted error.
Perhaps you're not like them, Atreides."
It could be a fault in their education, Paul said.
You say you're not for sale, but I believe I've the coin you'll accept.
For your loyalty, I offer my loyalty to you.
Totally.
My son has the Atreides sincerity, Jessica thought. He has that tremendous, almost naive honor. And what a powerful force that truly is.
She saw that Paul's words had shaken Kynes.
This is nonsense, Kynes said. You're just a boy, and...
I'm the Duke, Paul said. I'm an Atreides. No Atreides has ever broken such a bond.
Kynes swallowed.
When I say totally, Paul said, I mean without reservation. I would give my life for you.
Sire, Kynes said, and the word was torn from him, but Jessica saw that he was not now speaking to a boy of 15, but to a man, to a superior. Now Kynes meant the word.
In this moment, he'd give his life for Paul, she thought.
How do the Atreides accomplish this thing so quickly?
so easily. I know you mean this, Kynes said. Yet the Harkin... The door behind Paul slammed open. He whirled to see reeling violence. Shouting, the clash of steel, wax-imaged faces grimacing in the passage. With his mother beside him, Paul leaped for the door, seeing Idaho blocking the passage, his blood-pitted eyes there visible through a shield blur, claw hands beyond him, arcs of steel chopping futilely at the shield. There was the orange fire mouth of a stunner repelled by the shield. Idaho's blades were through it all, flick-flicking, red dripping from them. Then Kynes was beside Paul, and they threw their weight against the door. Paul had one last glimpse of Idaho standing against a swarm of Harkonnen uniforms. His jerking, controlled staggers, the black goat hair with a red blossom of death in it. Then the door was closed, and there came a snick as Kynes threw the bolts. I appear to have decided, Kynes said. Someone detected your machinery before it was shut down, Paul said. He pulled his mother away from the door, met the despair in her eyes. I should have suspected trouble when the coffee failed to arrive, Kynes said. You've a bolt hole out of here, Paul said. Shall we use it? Kynes took a deep breath, said, This door should hold for at least 20 minutes against all but a laser gun. They'll not use a laser gun for fear we've shields on this side, Paul said. Those were Sardaukar in Harkonnen uniform, Jessica whispered. They could hear pounding on the door now, rhythmic blows. Kynes indicated the cabinets against the right-hand wall, said, This way. He crossed to the first cabinet, opened a drawer, manipulated a handle within it. The entire wall of cabinets swung open to expose the black mouth of a tunnel. This door also is plasteel, Kynes said. You were well prepared, Jessica said. We lived under the Harkonnens for 80 years, Kynes said. He herded them into the darkness, closed the door. In the sudden blackness, Jessica saw a luminous arrow on the floor ahead of her. Kynes's voice came from behind them. We'll separate here. This wall is tougher. It'll stand for at least an hour. Follow the arrows like that one on the floor. They'll be extinguished by your passage. They lead through a maze to another exit where I've secreted a thopter. There's a storm across the desert tonight. Your only hope is to run for that storm. Dive into the top of it. Ride with it. My people have done this in stealing thopters. If you stay high in the storm, you'll survive. What of you? Paul asked. I'll try to escape another way. If I'm captured, well, I'm still Imperial Planetologist. I can say I was your captive. Running like cowards, Paul thought. But how else can I live to avenge my father? He turned to face the door. Jessica heard him move, said, Duncan's dead, Paul. You saw the wound. You can do nothing for him. I'll take full payment for them all one day, Paul said. Not unless you hurry now, Kynes said. Paul felt the man's hand on his shoulder. Where will we meet, Kynes? Paul asked. I'll send Fremen searching for you. The storm's path is known. Hurry now, and the Great Mother give you speed and luck. They heard him go, a scrambling in the blackness. Jessica found Paul's hand, pulled him gently. We must not get separated, she said. Yes. He followed her across the first arrow, seeing it go black as they touched it. Another arrow beckoned ahead. They crossed it, saw it extinguish itself, saw another arrow ahead. They were running now. Plans within plans, Jessica thought. Have we become part of someone else's plan now? The arrows led them around turnings, past side openings only dimly sensed in the faint luminescence. Their way slanted downward for a time, then up, ever up. They came finally to steps, rounded a corner, and were brought short by a glowing wall with a dark handle visible in its center. Paul pressed the handle. The wall swung away from them. Light flared to reveal a rock-hewn cavern with an ornithopter squatting in its center. A flat gray wall with a door sign on it loomed beyond the aircraft. "Where did Kynes go?" Jessica asked. "He did what any good guerrilla leader would," Paul said. "He separated us into two parties and arranged that he couldn't reveal where we are if he's captured. He won't really know." Paul drew her into the room, noting how their feet kicked up dust on the floor. "No one's been here for a long time," he said. "He seemed confident the Fremen could find us," she said. "I share that confidence." Paul released her hand, crossed to the ornithopter's left door, opened it, and secured his pack in the rear. "This ship's proximity masked," he said. "Instrument panel has remote door control, light control. 80 years under the Harkonnens taught them to be thorough." Jessica leaned against the craft's other side, catching her breath. "The Harkonnens will have a covering force over this area," she said. "They are not stupid." She considered her direction sense, pointed right. "The storm we saw is that way." Paul nodded, fighting an abrupt reluctance to move. He knew its cause, but found no help in the knowledge. Somewhere this night he had passed a decision nexus into the deep unknown. He knew the time area surrounding them, but the here and now existed as a place of mystery. It was as though he had seen himself from a distance go out of sight down into a valley. Of the countless paths up out of that valley, some might carry a Paul Atreides back into sight, but many would not. "The longer we wait, the better prepared they'll be," Jessica said. "Get in and strap yourself down," he said. He joined her in the ornithopter, still wrestling with the thought that this was blind ground, unseen in any prescient vision. And he realized with an abrupt sense of shock that he had been giving more and more reliance to prescient memory, and it had weakened him for this particular emergency. "If you rely only on your eyes, your other senses weaken." It was a Bene Gesserit axiom. He took it to himself now, promising never again to fall into that trap, if he lived through this. Paul fastened his safety harness, saw that his mother was secure, checked the aircraft. The wings were at full spread rest, their delicate metal interleavings extended. He touched the retractor bar, watched the wings shorten for jet boost takeoff the way Gurney Halleck had taught him. The starter switch moved easily. Dials on the instrument panel came alive as the jet pods were armed. Turbines began their slow hissing. "Ready?" he asked. "Yes." He touched the remote control for lights. Darkness blanketed them. His hand was a shadow against the luminous dials as he tripped the remote door control. Grating sounded ahead of them. A cascade of sand swished away to silence. A dusty breeze touched Paul's cheeks. He closed his door, feeling the sudden pressure. A wide patch of dust-blurred stars framed in angular darkness appeared where the door wall had been. Starlight defined a shelf beyond, a suggestion of sand ripples. Paul depressed the glowing action sequence switch on his panel. The wings snapped back and down, hurling the thopter out of its nest. Power surged from the jet pods as the wings locked into lift attitude. Jessica let her hands ride lightly on the dual controls, feeling the sureness of her son's movements. She was frightened, yet exhilarated. Now, Paul's training is our only hope, she thought. His youth and swiftness. Paul fed more power to the jet pods. The thopter banked, sinking them into their seats as a dark wall lifted against the stars ahead. He gave the craft more wing, more power. Another burst of lifting wing beats, and they came out over rocks, silver frosted angles and outcroppings in the starlight. The dust-reddened second moon showed itself above the horizon to their right, defining the ribbon trail of the storm. Paul's hands danced over the controls. Wings snicked into beetle stubs. G-force pulled at their flesh as the craft came around in a tight bank. Jet flares behind us, Jessica said. I saw them. He slammed the power arm forward. Their thopter leaped like a frightened animal, surged southwest toward the storm and the great curve of desert. In the near distance, Paul saw scattered shadows telling where the line of rocks ended, the basement complex sinking beneath the dunes. Beyond stretched moonlit fingernail shadows, dunes diminishing one into another. And above the horizon climbed the flat immensity of the storm like a wall against the stars. Something jarred the thopter. Shellburst, Jessica gasped. They're using some kind of projectile weapon. She saw a sudden animal grin on Paul's face. They seem to be avoiding their laser guns, he said. But we've no shields. Do they know that? Again, the thopter shuddered. Paul twisted to peer back. Only one of them appears to be fast enough to keep up with us. He returned his attention to their course, watching the storm wall grow high in front of them. It loomed like a tangible solid. Projectile launchers, rockets, all the ancient weaponry. That's one thing we'll give the Fremen, Paul whispered. The storm, Jessica said. Hadn't you better turn? What about the ship behind us? He's pulling up. Now! Paul stubbed the wings, banked hard left into the deceptively slow boiling of the storm wall, felt his cheeks pull in the G-force. They appeared to glide into a slow clouding of dust that grew heavier and heavier until it blotted out the desert and the moon. The aircraft became a long, horizontal whisper of darkness, lighted only by the green luminosity of the instrument panel. Through Jessica's mind flashed all the warnings about such storms, that they cut metal like butter, etched flesh to bone, and ate away the bones. She felt the buffeting of dust-blanketed wind. It twisted them as Paul fought the controls. She saw him chop the power, felt the ship buck. The metal around them hissed and trembled. Sand! Jessica shouted. She saw the negative shake of his head in the light from the panel. Not much sand this high. But she could feel them sinking deeper into the maelstrom. Paul sent the wings to their full soaring length, heard them creak with the strain. He kept his eyes fixed on the instruments, gliding by instinct, fighting for altitude. The sound of their passage diminished. The thopter began rolling off to the left. Paul focused on the glowing globe within the attitude curve, fought his craft back to level flight. Jessica had the eerie feeling that they were standing still, that all motion was external. A vague tan flowing against the windows, a rumbling hiss reminded her of the powers around them. Winds to 700 or 800 kilometers an hour, she thought. Adrenaline edginess gnawed at her. I must not fear, she told herself, mouthing the words of the Bene Gesserit litany. Fear is the mind killer. Slowly, her long years of training prevailed. Calmness returned. We have the tiger by the tail, Paul whispered. We can't go down, can't land, and I don't think I can lift us out of this.
We'll have to ride it out. Calmness drained out of her. Jessica felt her teeth chattering, clamped them together. Then she heard Paul's voice, low and controlled, reciting the litany. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is the little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. And when it has gone past me, I will turn to see fear's path. Where the fear has gone, there will be nothing. Only I will remain. What do you despise? By this are you truly known. From Manual of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. They are dead, Baron, said Iachin Nefud, the guard captain. Both the woman and the boy are certainly dead. The Baron Vladimir Harkonnen sat up in the sleep suspensors of his private quarters. Beyond these quarters and enclosing him like a multi-shelled egg stretched the space frigate he had grounded on Arrakis. Here in his quarters, though, the ship's harsh metal was disguised with draperies, with fabric paddings and rare art objects. It is a certainty, the guard captain said. They are dead. The Baron shifted his gross body in the suspensors, focused his attention on an ebeline statue of a leaping boy in a niche across the room. Sleep faded from him. He straightened the padded suspensor beneath the fat folds of his neck, stared across the single glow globe of his bedchamber to the doorway where Captain Nefud stood blocked by the pentashield. They're certainly dead, Baron, the man repeated. The Baron noted the trace of Samuta dullness in Nefud's eyes. It was obvious the man had been deep within the drug's rapture when he received this report, and had stopped only to take the antidote before rushing here. I have a full report, Nefud said. Let him sweat a little, the Baron thought. One must always keep the tools of statecraft sharp and ready. Power and fear, sharp and ready. Have you seen their bodies? The Baron rumbled. Nefud hesitated. Well? My lord, they were seen to dive into a sandstorm. Winds over 800 kilometers. Nothing survives such a storm, my lord. Nothing. One of our own craft was destroyed in the pursuit. The Baron stared at Nefud, noting the nervous twitch in the scissors line of the man's jaw muscles, the way the chin moved as Nefud swallowed. You have seen the bodies, the Baron asked. My lord, for what purpose do you come here rattling your armor? The Baron roared. To tell me a thing is certain when it is not? Do you think I'll praise you for such stupidity? Give you another promotion? Nefud's face went bone pale. Look at the chicken, the Baron thought. I am surrounded by such useless clods. If I scattered sand before this creature and told him it was grain, he'd peck at it. The man Idaho led us to them, then, the Baron asked. Yes, my lord. Look how he blurts out his answer, the Baron thought. He said they were attempting to flee to the Fremen, eh? Yes, my lord. Is there more to this report? The Imperial planetologist Kynes is involved, my lord. Idaho joined this Kynes under mysterious circumstances. I might even say suspicious circumstances. So? They fled together to a place in the desert where it's apparent the boy and his mother were hiding. In the excitement of the chase, several of our groups were caught in a lasergun shield explosion. How many did we lose? I'm not sure yet, my lord. He's lying, the Baron thought. It must have been pretty bad. The Imperial lackey, this Kynes, the Baron said. He was playing a double game, eh? I'd stake my reputation on it, my lord. His reputation. Have the man killed, the Baron said.
My lord, Kynes is the Imperial planetologist. His Majesty's own serv—
Make it look like an accident, then.
My lord, there were Sardaukar with our forces in the subjugation of this Fremen nest. They have Kynes in custody now.
Get him away from them. Say I wish to question him.
If they demur?
They will not if you handle it correctly. Nefud swallowed.
Yes, my lord.
The man must die, the Baron rumbled. He tried to help my enemies. Nefud shifted from one foot to the other.
Well?
My lord, the Sardaukar have two persons in custody who might be of interest to you. They've caught the Duke's master of assassins.
Hawat?
Thufir Hawat.
I've seen the captive myself, my lord.
'Tis Hawat.
I'd not have believed it possible.
They say he was knocked out by a stunner, my lord, in the desert where he couldn't use his shield. He's virtually unharmed. If we can get our hands on him, he'll provide great sport.
This is a Mentat you speak of, the Baron growled. One doesn't waste a Mentat.
Has he spoken? What does he say of his defeat? Could he know the extent of...
But no.
He has spoken only enough, my lord, to reveal his belief that the Lady Jessica was his betrayer.
Ah.
The Baron sank back, thinking. Then, you're sure? It's the Lady Jessica who attracts his anger.
He said it in my presence, my lord.
Let him think she's alive, then.
But, my lord,
be quiet. I wish Hawat treated kindly. He must be told nothing of the late Dr. Yui, his true betrayer. Let it be said that Dr. Yui died defending his duke.
In a way, this may even be true.
We will instead feed his suspicions against the Lady Jessica.
My lord, I don't...
The way to control and direct a Mentat, Nefud, is through his information.
False information. False results.
Yes, my lord. But is Hawat hungry? Thirsty?
My lord, Hawat's still in the hands of the Sardaukar.
Yes. Indeed, yes. But the Sardaukar will be as anxious to get information from Hawat as I am. I've noticed a thing about our allies, Nefud. They are not very devious, politically. I do believe this is a deliberate thing. The Emperor wants it that way.
Yes, I do believe it.
You will remind the Sardaukar commander of my renown at obtaining information from reluctant subjects.
Nefud looked unhappy.
Yes, my lord. You will tell the Sardaukar commander that I wish to question both Hawat and this Kynes at the same time, playing one off against the other.
He can understand that much, I think.
Yes, my lord.
And once we have them in our hands, the Baron nodded.
My lord, the Sardaukar will want an observer with you during any questioning. I'm sure we can produce an emergency to draw off any unwanted observers, Nefud.
I understand, my lord.
That's when Kynes can have his accident.
Both Kynes and Hawat will have accidents then, Nefud, but only Kynes will have a real accident.
It's Hawat I want. Yes. Ah, yes.
Nafood blinked, swallowed. He appeared about to ask a question, but remained silent.
Hawat will be given both food and drink, the Baron said, treated with kindness, with sympathy. In his water you will administer the residual poison developed by the late Pieter de Vries, and you will see that the antidote becomes a regular part of Hawat's diet from this point on, unless I say otherwise.
The antidote, yes.
Nafood shook his head. But don't be dense, Nafood. The Duke almost killed me with that poison capsule tooth. The gas he exhaled into my presence deprived me of my most valuable mentat, Pieter. I need a replacement.
Hawat?
Hawat. But you're going to say how it's completely loyal to the Atreides.
True, but the Atreides are dead.
We will woo him. He must be convinced he's not to blame for the Duke's demise. It was all the doing of that Bene Gesserit witch. He had an inferior master, one whose reason was clouded by emotion. Mentats admire the ability to calculate without emotion, Nafood. We will woo the formidable Thufir Hawat.
Hawat, unfortunately, had a master whose resources were poor, one who could not elevate a Mentat to the sublime peaks of reasoning that are a Mentat's right. Hawat will see a certain element of truth in this. The Duke couldn't afford the most efficient spies to provide his Mentat with the required information.
The Baron stared at Nafood. Let us never deceive ourselves, Nafood. The truth is a powerful weapon. We know how we overwhelmed the Atreides. Hawat knows, too. We did it with wealth.
With wealth? Yes, my lord.
We will woo Hawat, the Baron said. We will hide him from the Sardaukar, and we will hold in reserve the withdrawal of the antidote for the poison. There's no way of removing the residual poison. And, Nafood, Hawat need never suspect. The antidote will not betray itself to a poison snooper. Hawat can scan his food as he pleases and detect no trace of poison.
Nafood's eyes opened wide with understanding.
The absence of a thing, the Baron said. This can be as deadly as the presence.
The absence of air, huh?
The absence of water? The absence of anything else we're addicted to.
The Baron nodded.
You understand me, Nafood?
Nafood swallowed.
Yes, my lord.
Then get busy. Find the Sardaukar commander and set things in motion.
At once, my lord.
Nafood bowed, turned, and hurried away.
Hawat by my side, the Baron thought. The Sardaukar will give him to me. If they suspect anything at all, it's that I wish to destroy the Mentat. And this suspicion I'll confirm. The fools. One of the most formidable Mentats in all history. A Mentat trained to kill. And they'll toss him to me like some silly toy to be broken. I will show them what use can be made of such a toy.
The Baron reached beneath a drapery beside his suspensor bed, pressed a button to summon his older nephew, Rabban. He sat back, smiling.
And all the Atreides dead.
The stupid guard captain had been right, of course. Certainly nothing survived in the path of a sandblast storm on Arrakis. Not an ornithopter,
or its occupants.
The woman and the boy were dead. The bribes in the right places, the unthinkable expenditure to bring overwhelming military force down onto one planet, all the sly reports tailored for the Emperor's ears alone, all the careful scheming were here at last coming to full fruition. Power and fear. Fear and power. The Baron could see the path ahead of him. One day, a Harkonnen would be emperor. Not himself, and no spawn of his loins, but a Harkonnen. Not this Raban he'd summoned, of course, but Raban's younger brother, young Fade Rautha. There was a sharpness to the boy that the Baron enjoyed, a ferocity. A lovely boy, the Baron thought. A year or two more. Say, by the time he's 17, I'll know for certain whether he's the tool that House Harkonnen requires to gain the throne. Milord Baron. The man who stood outside the doorfield of the Baron's bedchamber was low-built, gross of face and body, with the Harkonnen paternal line's narrow-set eyes and bulge of shoulders. There was yet some rigidity in his fat, but it was obvious to the eye that he'd come one day to the portable suspensors for carrying his excess weight. A muscle-minded tank brain, the Baron thought. No Mentat, my nephew. Not a Piter de Vries, but perhaps something more precisely devised for the task at hand. If I give him freedom to do it, he'll grind over everything in his path. Oh, how he'll be hated here on Arrakis. My dear Raban, the Baron said. He released the doorfield, but pointedly kept his body shield at full strength, knowing that the shimmer of it would be visible above the bedside glow-globe. "You summoned me," Raban said. He stepped into the room, flicked a glance past the air disturbance of the body shield, searched for a suspensor chair, found none. "Stand closer where I can see you easily," the Baron said. Raban advanced another step, thinking that the damnable old man had deliberately removed all chairs, forcing a visitor to stand. "The Atreides are dead," the Baron said. "The last of them. That's why I summoned you here to Arrakis. This planet is again yours." Raban blinked. "But I thought you were going to advance Piter de Vries to the..." "Piter, too, is dead."
"Piter?"
"Piter." The Baron reactivated the doorfield, blanked it against all energy penetration.
"You finally tired of him, huh?" Raban asked. His voice fell flat and lifeless in the energy-blanketed room.
"I will say a thing to you just this once," the Baron rumbled. "You insinuate that I obliterated Piter as one obliterates a trifle." He snapped fat fingers. "Just like that, eh?" "I am not so stupid, nephew. I will take it unkindly if ever again you suggest by word or action that I am so stupid."
Fear showed in the squinting of Raban's eyes. He knew within certain limits how far the old Baron would go against family. Seldom to the point of death unless there were outrageous profit or provocation in it. But family punishments could be painful.
"Forgive me, Milord Baron," Raban said. He lowered his eyes as much to hide his own anger as to show subservience.
"You do not fool me, Raban," the Baron said. Raban kept his eyes lowered, swallowed.
"I make a point," the Baron said.
Never obliterate a man unthinkingly, the way an entire fief might do it through some due process of law. Always do it for an overriding purpose, and know your purpose.
Anger spoke in Rabban. But you obliterated the traitor, Yui. I saw his body being carried out as I arrived last night.
Rabban stared at his uncle, suddenly frightened by the sound of those words. But the Baron smiled.
I'm very careful about dangerous weapons, he said. Dr. Yui was a traitor. He gave me the Duke.
Strength poured into the Baron's voice. I suborned a doctor of the Sook School, the Inner School. You hear, boy? But that's a wild sort of weapon to leave lying about. I didn't obliterate him casually.
Does the Emperor know you suborned a Sook doctor?
This was a penetrating question, the Baron thought. Have I misjudged this nephew?
The Emperor doesn't know it yet, the Baron said. But his Sardaukar are sure to report it to him.
Before that happens, though, I'll have my own report in his hands through Chome Company channels. I will explain that I luckily discovered a doctor who pretended to the conditioning. A false doctor, you understand. Since everyone knows you cannot counter the conditioning of a Sook school, this will be accepted.
Ah, I see, Rabban murmured.
And the Baron thought, indeed, I hope you do see. I hope you do see how vital it is that this remain secret.
The Baron suddenly wondered at himself.
Why did I do that? Why did I boast to this fool nephew of mine? The nephew I must use and discard.
The Baron felt anger at himself. He felt betrayed.
It must be kept secret, Rabban said. I understand.
The Baron sighed. I give you different instructions about Arrakis this time, nephew. When last you ruled this place, I held you in strong rein. This time, I have only one requirement.
M'lord?
Income.
Income?
Have you any idea, Rabban, how much we spent to bring such military force to bear on the Atreides? Do you have even the first inkling of how much the Guild charges for military transport?
Expensive, huh?
Expensive?
The Baron shot a fat arm toward Rabban.
If you squeeze Arrakis for every cent it can give us for 60 years, you'll just barely repay us.
Rabban opened his mouth, closed it without speaking.
Expensive, the Baron sneered. The damnable Guild monopoly on space would have ruined us if I hadn't planned for this expense long ago. You should know, Rabban, that we bore the entire brunt of it. We even paid for transport of the Sardaukar.
And not for the first time the Baron wondered if there ever would come a day when the Guild might be circumvented. They were insidious, bleeding off just enough to keep the host from objecting until they had you in their fist, where they could force you to pay and pay and pay. Always the exorbitant demands rode upon military ventures.
Hazard rates, the oily Guild agents explained. And for every agent you managed to insert as a watchdog in the Guild bank structure, they put 2 agents into your system.
Insufferable.
Income, then, Rabban said.
The Baron lowered his arm, made a fist.
You must squeeze.
And I may do anything I wish as long as I squeeze.
Anything.
The cannons you brought, Raban said. Could I? I'm removing them, the Baron said.
But you won't need such toys. They were a special innovation and are now useless. We need the metal. They cannot go against a shield, Raban. They were merely the unexpected. It was predictable that the Duke's men would retreat into cliff caves on this abominable planet. Our cannon merely sealed them in.
The Fremen don't use shields.
You may keep some laser guns if you wish.
Yes, my lord. And I have a free hand.
As long as you squeeze.
Raban's smile was gloating. I understand perfectly, my lord.
You understand nothing perfectly, the Baron growled. Let us have that clear at the outset. What you do understand is how to carry out my orders. Has it occurred to you, nephew, that there are at least 5 million persons on this planet?
Does my lord forget that I was his regent Cyrodiil here before? And if my lord will forgive me, his estimate may be low. It's difficult to count a population scattered among sinks and pans the way they are here. And when you consider the Fremen of...
The Fremen aren't worth considering.
Forgive me, my lord, but the Sardaukar believe otherwise. The Baron hesitated, staring at his nephew.
You know something?
My lord had retired when I arrived last night. I took the liberty of contacting some of my lieutenants from before. They've been acting as guides to the Sardaukar. They report that a Fremen band ambushed a Sardaukar force somewhere southeast of here and wiped it out.
Wiped out? A Sardaukar force?
Yes, my lord.
Impossible!
Raban shrugged.
Fremen defeating Sardaukar, the Baron sneered.
I repeat only what was reported to me, Raban said. It is said this Fremen force already had captured the Duke's redoubtable Thufir Hawat.
Ah.
The Baron nodded, smiling. I believe the report, Raban said. You've no idea what a problem the Fremen were.
Perhaps. But these weren't Fremen your lieutenants saw. They must have been Atreides men trained by Howard and disguised as Fremen. It's the only possible answer.
Again, Raban shrugged. Well, the Sardaukar think they were Fremen. The Sardaukar already have launched a program to wipe out all Fremen.
Good.
But it'll keep the Sardaukar occupied. And we'll soon have Hawat.
I know it. I can feel it. Ah, this has been a day. The Sardaukar off hunting a few useless desert bands while we get the real prize.
My lord, Raban hesitated, frowning. I've always felt that we underestimated the Fremen, both in numbers and in...
Ignore them, boy. They are rabble. It's the populous towns, cities, and villages that concern us. A great many people there, huh?
A great many, my lord.
They worry me, Raban.
Worry you?
Oh, 90% of them are of no concern. But there are always a few. Houses minor and so on. People of ambition who might try a dangerous thing. If one of them should get off Arrakis with an unpleasant story about what happened here, I'd be most displeased. Have you any idea how displeased I'd be?
Raban swallowed.
You must take immediate measures to hold a hostage from each House Minor, the Baron said. As far as anyone off Arrakis must learn, this was straightforward house-to-house battle. The Sardaukar had no part in it, you understand? The Duke was offered the usual quarter and exile, but he died in an unfortunate accident before he could accept. He was about to accept, though. That is the story. And any rumor that there were Sardaukar here, it must be laughed at.
As the Emperor wishes it, Raban said.
As the Emperor wishes it.
What about the smugglers?
No one believes smugglers, Raban. They are tolerated, but not believed. At any rate, you will be spreading some bribes in that quarter, and taking other measures, which I'm sure you can think of.
Yes, my lord.
Two things from Arrakis, then, Raban. Income and a merciless fist. You must show no mercy here. Think of these clods as what they are, slaves envious of their masters and waiting only the opportunity to rebel. Not the slightest vestige of pity or mercy must you show them.
Can one exterminate an entire planet? Raban asked.
Exterminate? Surprise showed in the swift turning of the Baron's head. Who said anything about exterminating?
Well, I presumed you were going to bring in new stock, and
I said squeeze, nephew, not exterminate. Don't waste the population. Merely drive them into utter submission. You must be the carnivore, my boy.
He smiled, a baby's expression in the dimple fat face. A carnivore never stops. Show no mercy.
Never stop. Mercy is a chimera. It can be defeated by the stomach rumbling its hunger, by the throat crying its thirst. You must be always hungry and thirsty.
The Baron caressed his bulges beneath the suspensors.
Like me.
I see, my lord.
Raban swung his gaze left and right. It's all clear then, nephew.
Except for one thing, uncle. The planetologist, Kynes.
Ah, yes. Kynes.
He's the Emperor's man, my lord. He can come and go as he pleases. And he's very close to the Fremen. Married one.
Kynes will be dead by tomorrow's nightfall.
That's dangerous work, uncle. Killing an Imperial servant.
How do you think I've come this far, this quickly? The Baron demanded.
His voice was low, charged with unspeakable adjectives.
Besides, you need never have feared Kynes would leave Arrakis. You're forgetting that he's addicted to the spice.
Of course.
Those who know will do nothing to endanger their supply, the Baron said. Kynes certainly must know.
I forgot, Raban said. They stared at each other in silence.
Presently the Baron said, incidentally, you will make my own supply one of your first concerns. I've quite a stockpile of private stuff, but that suicide raid by the Duke's men got most of what we'd stored for sale.
Raban nodded.
Yes, my lord.
The Baron brightened. Now, tomorrow morning, you will assemble what remains of organization here, and you'll say to them, "Our sublime Padishah Emperor has charged me to take possession of this planet and end all dispute."
I understand, my lord. This time, I'm sure you do. We will discuss it in more detail tomorrow. Now leave me to finish my sleep.
The Baron deactivated his door field, watched his nephew out of sight.
A tank brain, the Baron thought. Muscle-minded tank brain. They will be bloody pulp here when he's through with them. Then, when I send in Fader Arthur to take the load off them, they'll cheer their rescuer. Beloved Fader Arthur, benign Fader Arthur, the compassionate one who saves them from a beast. Fader Arthur, a man to follow and die for. The boy will know by that time how to oppress with impunity. I'm sure he's the one we need. He'll learn. And such a lovely body. Really a lovely boy.
At the age of 15, he had already learned silence. From A Child's History of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan. As Paul fought the Thopter's controls, he grew aware that he was sorting out the interwoven storm forces. His more than Mentat awareness computing on the basis of fractional minutiae. He felt dust fronts, billowings, mixings of turbulence, an occasional vortex. The cabin interior was an angry box lighted by the green radiance of instrument dials. The tan flow of dust outside appeared featureless, but his inner sense began to see through the curtain. I must find the right vortex, he thought. For a long time now, he had sensed the storm's power diminishing, but still it shook them. He waited out another turbulence. The vortex began as an abrupt billowing that rattled the entire ship. Paul defied all fear to bank the Thopter left. Jessica saw the maneuver on the attitude globe. Paul! She screamed. The vortex turned them, twisting, tipping. It lifted the Thopter like a chip on a geyser, spewed them up and out. A winged speck within a core of winding dust lighted by the second moon. Paul looked down, saw the dust-defined pillar of hot wind that had disgorged them, saw the dying storm trailing away like a dry river into the desert, moon-gray motion growing smaller and smaller below as they rode the updraft. "We're out of it," Jessica whispered. Paul turned their craft away from the dust in swooping rhythm while he scanned the night sky. "We've given them the slip," he said. Jessica felt her heart pounding. She forced herself to calmness, looked at the diminishing storm. Her time sense said they had ridden within that compounding of elemental forces almost 4 hours, but part of her mind computed the passage as a lifetime. She felt reborn. It was like the litany, she thought. We faced it and did not resist. The storm passed through us and around us. It's gone, but we remain. I don't like the sound of our wing motion, Paul said. We suffered some damage in there.
He felt the grating, injured flight through his hands on the controls. They were out of the storm, but still not out into the full view of his prescient vision. Yet they had escaped, and Paul sensed himself trembling on the verge of a revelation. He shivered. The sensation was magnetic and terrifying, and he found himself caught on the question of what caused this trembling awareness. Part of it, he felt, was the spice-saturated diet of Arrakis. But he thought part of it could be the litany, as though the words had a power of their own. I shall not fear. Cause and effect. He was alive despite malignant forces, and he felt himself poised on a brink of self-awareness that could not have been without the litany's magic. Words from the Orange Catholic Bible rang through his memory. What senses do we lack that we cannot see or hear another world all around us? There's rock all around, Jessica said. Paul focused on the thopter's launching, shook his head to clear it. He looked where his mother pointed, saw uplifting rock shapes black on the sand ahead and to the right. He felt wind around his ankles, a stirring of dust in the cabin. There was a hole somewhere, more of the storm's doing. Better set us down on sand, Jessica said. The wings might not take full break. He nodded toward a place ahead where sand-blasted ridges lifted into moonlight above the dunes. I'll set us down near those rocks. Check your safety harness. She obeyed, thinking, we've water and stillsuits. If we can find food, we can survive a long time on this desert. Fremen live here. What they can do, we can do. Run for those rocks the instant we're stopped, Paul said. I'll take the pack. Run for... She fell silent, nodded. Worms. Our friends, the worms, he corrected her. They'll get this thopter. There'll be no evidence of where we landed. How direct his thinking, she thought. They glided lower, lower. There came a rushing sense of motion to their passage. Blurred shadows of dunes, rocks lifting like islands. The thopter touched a dune top with a soft lurch, skipped a sand valley, touched another dune. He's killing our speed against the sand, Jessica thought, and permitted herself to admire his competence. Brace yourself, Paul warned. He pulled back on the wing brakes, gently at first, then harder and harder. He felt them cup the air, their aspect ratio dropping faster and faster. Wind screamed through the lapped coverts and primaries of the wings' leaves. Abruptly, with only the faintest lurch of warning, the left wing, weakened by the storm, twisted upward and in, slamming across the side of the thopter. The craft skidded across a dune top, twisting to the left. It tumbled down the opposite face to bury its nose in the next dune amid a cascade of sand. They lay stopped on the broken wing side, the right wing pointing toward the stars. Paul jerked off his safety harness, hurled himself upward across his mother, wrenching the door open. Sand poured around them into the cabin, bringing a dry smell of burned flint. He grabbed the pack from the rear, saw that his mother was free of her harness. She stepped up onto the side of the right-hand seat and out onto the thopter's metal skin. Paul followed, dragging the pack by its straps. Run, he ordered. He pointed up the dune face and beyond it, where they could see a rock tower undercut by sandblast winds. Jessica leaped off the thopter and ran, scrambling and sliding up the dune. She heard Paul's panting progress behind. They came out onto a sand ridge that curved away toward the rocks. Follow the ridge, Paul ordered. It'll be faster. They slogged toward the rocks, sand gripping their feet. A new sound began to impress itself on them. A muted whisper, a hissing, an abrasive slithering. "Worm," Paul said. It grew louder. "Faster," Paul gasped. The first rock shingle, like a beach slanting from the sand, lay no more than 10 meters ahead when they heard the metal crunch and shatter behind them. Paul shifted his pack to his right arm, holding it by the straps. It slapped his side as he ran. He took his mother's arm with his other hand. They scrambled onto the lifting rock, up a pebble-littered surface through a twisted, wind-carved channel. Breath came dry and gasping in their throats. "I can't run any farther," Jessica panted. Paul stopped, pressed her into a gut of rock, turned and looked down onto the desert. A mound in motion ran parallel to their rock island. Moonlit ripples, sand waves, a cresting burrow almost level with Paul's eyes at a distance of about a kilometer. The flattened dunes of its track curved once, a short loop crossing the patch of desert where they had abandoned their wrecked ornithopter. Where the worm had been, there was no sign of the aircraft. The burrow mound moved outward into the desert, coursed back across its own path, questing. "It's bigger than a Guild spaceship," Paul whispered. "I was told worms grew large in the deep desert, but I didn't realize." "How big?"
"Nor I," Jessica breathed.
Again the thing turned out away from the rocks, sped now with a curving track toward the horizon. They listened until the sound of its passage was lost in gentle sand stirrings around them. Paul took a deep breath, looked up at the moon-frosted escarpment, and quoted from the Kitab al-Ibar, "Travel by night and rest in black shade through the day." He looked at his mother. "We still have a few hours of night. Can you go on?"
"In a moment."
Paul stepped out onto the rock shingle, shouldered the pack, and adjusted its straps. He stood a moment with a paracompass in his hands. "Whenever you're ready," he said. She pushed herself away from the rock, feeling her strength return.
"Which direction?"
"Where this ridge leads," he pointed.
"Deep into the desert," she said.
"The Fremen desert," Paul whispered. And he paused, shaken by the remembered high-relief imagery of a prescient vision he had experienced on Caladan. He had seen this desert. But the set of the vision had been subtly different, like an optical image that had disappeared into his consciousness, been absorbed by memory, and now failed of perfect registry when projected onto the real scene. The vision appeared to have shifted and approached him from a different angle while he remained motionless. "Idaho was with us in the vision," he remembered. "But now, Idaho is dead." "Do you see a way to go?" Jessica asked, mistaking his hesitation.
"No," he said.
"But we'll go anyway." He settled his shoulders more firmly in the pack, struck out up a sand-carved channel in the rock. The channel opened onto a moonlit floor of rock with benched ledges climbing away to the south. Paul headed for the first ledge, clambered onto it. Jessica followed. She noted presently how their passage became a matter of the immediate and particular. The sand pockets between rocks where their steps were slowed, the wind-carved ridge that cut their hands, the obstruction that forced a choice, go over or go around. The terrain enforced its own rhythms. They spoke only when necessary and then with the hoarse voices of their exertion.
"Careful here. This ledge is slippery with sand. Watch you don't hit your head against this overhang. Stay below this ridge. The moon's at our backs, and it'd show our movement to anyone out there."
Paul stopped in a bight of rock, leaned the pack against a narrow ledge. Jessica leaned beside him, thankful for the moment of rest. She heard Paul pulling at his stillsuit tube, sipped her own reclaimed water. It tasted brackish, and she remembered the waters of Caladan. A tall fountain enclosing a curve of sky, such a richness of moisture that it hadn't been noticed for itself. Only for its shape, or its reflection, or its sound as she stopped beside it. To stop, she thought. To rest. Truly rest. It occurred to her that mercy was the ability to stop, if only for a moment. There was no mercy where there could be no stopping. Paul pushed away from the rock ledge, turned and climbed over a sloping surface. Jessica followed with a sigh.
This book is continued on Disc 11.